Are you craving what I'm craving? Start your Penn Station online order for a $7.99 Penn Pair Combo. A great deal on craveable subs and fresh cut fries. Pair small fries with a small chicken teriyaki, chicken cordon bleu, or pizza sub to satisfy your cravings without spending big. Our menu features mouth-watering sub sandwiches, fresh cut fries, and hand-squeezed lemonade. But hurry, $7.99 is only for a limited time. Love your sub at Penn Station. Order in-app or online at penn-station.com for delivery to your door.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Marcus Kane. Marcus is a nutrition coach who helps individuals to beat binge eating and to create a rewarding relationship with food and exercise. Marcus joins us today to discuss binge eating and overeating and how you can step away from binge behaviours and gain the freedom from food that you deserve. Hello, Marcus.
Hey, Hannah. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Feeling good. It's nice and sunny outside, so spring has finally arrived and I feel so much happier. Like, my mood has elevated since the sun has come back.
It's noticeable, isn't it? Like, when you go outside after a few months of grey and the sun's out, you're like, oh wow, this actually does feel different.
Yeah, and it's like, I think the biggest shock for me was the evenings of like, oh god, I finished work and then I'm still able to go out and do stuff. And that's I went great. For a walk on Sunday with my friends and it was so nice to just like be in a jumper and just wandering around rather than like a massive trench coat because it's so cold.
Yeah, 100%. I'm a huge fan of it staying lighter for longer, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I was saying to my mum the other day, it's kind of like funny how all the things come at once because you have like the miserable winter and then all of a sudden you've got like really beautiful flowers and it's sun shining and the days are longer. It's like, can't we have like some of those elements in the winter just to keep us going as well rather than being awful and then wonderful?
Yeah, I know. Like what to keep going through the winter? I mean, I always find myself looking forward to Christmas. Mm-hmm. So the moment winter starts to hit, I'm like, oh no, but that's okay because we've got all this really cool Christmas stuff coming. Mm-hmm. And obviously moving from Australia to the UK, in the UK now, I get to experience Christmas as I read about it in all like the stories that I was reading growing up. So it's really magical for me, like getting cold Christmases now and that real storybook Christmas. So I love that. And then my birthday is in January. So that kind of gets me through January. But then when February hits, I'm kind of like, all right, I'm done with this now. Can we move it along?
What date's your birthday?
The 27th.
Mine's the 28th.
Holy shit, really?
Yeah, that's so funny. when you said that, I was like, oh, I wonder if it's the same day. I did a podcast a few months ago and didn't talk about birthdays, got to the end. Her name was also Han, and she went by Han, and her surname began with a H. And then we were talking about, I think it was before Christmas, and we were talking about like, oh, it's okay because our birthday's afterwards. And she said January, and I was like, oh, when's your birthday? And she's like, 28th. And I was like, oh my god. But she was, I think, 4 years older than me, so it wasn't the same year, but that was very funny. Cool. So did you have like a barbecue for Christmas? Did you do the, because that's what you hear about what people do in Australia.
In Australia, yeah. So funnily enough, there's always like the combination of things. We have, or my family at least, had a very traditional like roast Christmas dinner.
Okay.
With kind of barbecue elements and other bits and pieces thrown in there. So last Christmas, or the last Christmas that I was in Australia for, my wife came with me and we were at my sister's house and we were obviously by the pool and everything like that. So it was this weird combination where we've got like the roast dinner, sitting by the pool, cold drinks, with a few barbecue things in there, it becomes it becomes a bit of a mess of different influences, but it's fun.
Yeah, that sounds so fun. But I'm also thinking, like, I just have a distinct memory of my mum making a roast for us, like, one summer, and we all just sat there like, it's way too hot to eat this. Like, I don't know how we're going to do this. So, yeah, I can imagine sitting by the pool with a roast. Do you have gravy? Because I feel like that would...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, wow.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
We just learn to eat winter meals when it's hot. Like, nice. You just do it. Yeah. It's a skill set.
Yeah. I like the perseverance. That is very good. But anyway, thank you so much for joining me today. So excited to chat to you. And I think this is a topic that a lot of people will find really helpful. So I wanted to start off maybe to learn a bit about yourself. So how did you get into the work that you're doing, sort of coaching people to step away from binge eating?
In short, I've always wanted to help people with what I consider to be the biggest limiting factors and the biggest problems. So I went through a career in the fitness industry that started with sports massage. From there, went to personal training. From there, went to nutrition coaching. And from nutrition coaching, I was like, okay, why are so many people experiencing these troubles? It's never really been enough for me to just lean on what we could call commonplace garden variety answers that we're all just meant to accept as the solution, even though they might not be working out for like 9 out of 10 people. I'm not satisfied with people coming to me for help and not walking away having their life changed dramatically for the better. So I've always wanted to be in the health and fitness space, and this process where I am now is just the result of pulling on that thread, finding the things that are really causing people problems. Because, you know, there are so many people who go into gyms or who might make some changes with their nutrition, and, you know, they do it relatively easily and they take to it like a duck to water, and it's fine, they have good experiences. But I'm always thinking, what about all the people who currently aren't having good experiences? What about, you know, like, I want this to be for everybody, and I want to help people avoid the traps and the problems that I fell into myself. So yeah, I guess that's why I'm here now in the disordered eating space.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing, because I think especially in like the fitness and diet industry now, it's like, if you can't kind of stick to these kind of things that we're suggesting would work, then it's your fault, and like, if you're not able to adhere to them long term, then that's your fault. I'm really interested to about the sort of traps that you mentioned there, that, you know, you've seen people fall into and your experience as well. So what are some of the sort of common traps that you've seen people fall into?
Definitely, it sounds very cliche, but overvaluing weight and shape. Like, overvaluing our appearance. And this is not to say that it's not human to be invested in our appearance. Like, it's normal to care about how we look, but we often fall into these traps of putting way, way too much value in the specifics of our appearance. Like, when overestimating what we're going to gain, or what we might gain, or what fulfillment or happiness we might find from having a very, very specific physical appearance. I think we could go, like, we could unpack that box for days in terms of why we end up with that belief system. But definitely that is a big one. Putting way too much stock in looking a certain way. And of course, you know, we want to take some pride in our appearance. It's okay to want to have autonomy regarding our appearance. 100% cool. But when we jump to conclusions about exactly how much benefit or fulfillment looking a certain way is going to bring to our lives without taking into account the bigger picture of our life, that's definitely going to cause problems. We start hyperfixating on weight and shape, on unsustainable dietary patterns. We develop obsessive or kind of compulsive tendencies with food and nutrition. We get into really dicey mental territory. So that losing perspective, I guess, is a huge, huge trap. And I think if we were to, I've seen this with a lot of the athletes that I've been lucky enough to be friends with and work with, that the people who are really, I guess, what we could call successful in maintaining a very, very long and happy relationship with food and exercise, and even achieving some of the aesthetic results that we might look at and go, oh, wow, that's cool. If we reverse engineer their process, they always start with a seed of curiosity regarding nutrition and exercise, mm-hmm. and pull on that thread, and they do what they're interested in, and they're constantly curious about, oh, what would happen if I trained like this, or what would happen if I, you know, changed my diet up in this way or did that. And they are approaching it from that perspective rather than from this approach of like, I'm not satisfied with myself, I need to hit certain benchmarks, I will give myself the approval and love that I feel, or I'll only give myself that when I reach a certain benchmark. Mm-hmm. So that's something kind of interesting to look at when we look at these traps, like the intent behind the different actions. Like two different people can perform essentially the same action, the same training plan, the same diet, the same everything, but they could have different, they can be in different emotional spaces and with different intents. And that is going to create a completely different path and result and experience for both those people. So those kind of traps, definitely, I fell into myself, and I'm working with people now to help avoid those.
Yeah. I think when you were speaking about the intent, I think that's such an important thing that we often don't consider, and putting all of the sort of, you know, your goals and your intentions around weight and shape, I think can be really dangerous. And I think it's really, you know, a lot of people have that as part of it, but I think, you know, maybe having different goals and different intentions. So, you know, like you were saying about athletes, it might be that they're doing a certain thing in order to improve their strength or improve their time, or, you know, different things like that. And that, as a sort of offset, might impact the weight. I mean, it probably will impact the way that their weight and shape appears. But I think the really key thing there that you said was not basing your success over like arbitrary things such as the way that you look. Because ultimately, like you said, we can say, okay, I want to have X characteristic about me, but you can't guarantee that particular behaviors are going to provide that. And it could be that they provide other elements to your life, like, you know, you might have more flexibility in your life, or you might have a better social life or whatever, but you're so blindsided because all you're focused on is that one specific aesthetic that doesn't come because, you know, potentially your body is not created in a way. I always think about things like abs, you know, abs are genetic, like some people will get them and some people can do exactly the same dietary patterns, exactly the same exercise. They're just not going to come. Some people might have them in a different shape or whatever.
Yeah.
But you'd be so focused on getting abs that you wouldn't look at all the other things that you've achieved from your new dietary patterns and the new exercise regime that you've got.
100%. And then we overvalue or we overestimate the gain or the benefit in achieving things like visible abs. Like, as you know, someone who's been there and done that and sacrificed a lot, went through a lot of years of disordered eating and eating disorders in maintaining that, the actual like sacrifice to reward ratio wasn't there. Like, it's not like if you achieve that, people will say, oh my God, you're an amazing person now. Anyone who finds, you know, your body fat percentage or whatever like that to be the most valuable thing about you or the most attractive thing about you, like, they can go fuck themselves. So, you know, it's this thing where we get into this cycle or this pattern of thinking, oh yeah, achieving that will bring me something. And it almost never does. And then we look at what you said in terms of, well, you know, some things are possible for some people, and it's not that something might be impossible for someone, but it's just the amount of sacrifice and work that might go into one person maintaining something like Visible Abs versus another person, and the reward that actually comes from that, it's completely out of whack.
Yeah, I think you're completely right. I think the reward that people perceive, you know, having abs or whatever, it's so glorified in society, and, you know, people see you as a quote unquote better person, you know, because of that. But, you know, actually, like you said, the people that think that probably are not people that you actually care about their opinions anyway. You know, it might be some random person at the gym that comments on you, and then it's like, okay, but by engaging in these activities, which mean that I'm getting these abs, I'm actually now not able to, you know, spend time with my loved ones or be engaged with my loved ones or whatever.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
And that is like, you know, that sacrifice that you said. So I guess my question would be, because I think it's so common that, you know, when people are, especially in the gym and things like that, to have almost superficial goals on, you know, based around aesthetics, how do you work with somebody to sort of shift that mindset? Because I don't think it's as easy as just saying, well, don't worry about, you know, getting abs or whatever, because in society, it's constantly, you know, you're constantly being bombarded with all these messages about how you should look.
Yeah, it is a very individual journey for every single person that I work with. I mean, this is one of the reasons why at this stage I don't really do group coaching. I only do one-to-one coaching in terms of this journey, because there is no formula for it. Like, there are common links and common factors and principles that we need to find a way to address, but the way that I discuss this process and work through this process with one person, if I was to write a book based on that particular experience with that person, it wouldn't resonate effectively for the next person. So it's about finding very much what resonates with you in terms of how you can really create corrective experiences that help you to feel differently, to genuinely feel different. Because we could sit here and say, love yourself regardless of your appearance, focus on intrinsic self-worth, focus on eating in a way that's both fun and allows you to enjoy life and as well is nourishing and healthy, exercise in a way that you enjoy. We all know that on paper, right? Like, we all know. But how do we feel in alignment with that? And the road to feeling that way, the road to feeling in good alignment with those principles, is to go on a bit of a journey that creates experiences that give you conviction behind the feelings associated with being in alignment with those actions, if that makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah. No, I think it does. I think it's so easy to just say things, you know, like, love yourself or whatever, but actually, and I think this ties in so nicely to kind of like fitness and diets and stuff like that, is as a society we just want a quick fix. Like, we want the thing that's the easiest thing to do and the quickest thing to do. And whether it's fitness, whether it's you know, adjusting how you're eating, whether it's learning that you're learning about yourself, those things take time. And I think that's, you know, that's why it's not just a one size fits all easy answer of, you know, in order to, you know, like yourself, you just have to tell yourself that you like yourself, and you just have to say in the mirror every day, I like myself. You know, that is an element that you could do, but it takes so long. And I think that's what I've really find interesting about, you know, when I speak to individuals that have had their own personal experience and are now supporting others, it's incredible because they're able to bring their experience to the table and, you know, share what they've been through. But equally, you know, that's still going to take time for that other person to find that place themselves, which can be a hard thing to kind of accept. You know, I just want to love myself now. Like, I don't want to take years or whatever to, and obviously it's a process, isn't it? It's not just like you wake up 5 years later and all of a sudden like, oh my God, I'm amazing. I'm finally yeah. at that place. But yeah, I think it's accepting that change takes time. And that in itself is hard.
That is, I think that's definitely one of the biggest obstacles for most people. I mean, all of us. Is, you know, thinking, right, doing something the right way. And by the right way, I mean in a way that's going to produce long-term success that stays with us. Often things that produce that long-term success and real change aren't the things that are going to produce immediate relief in the moment from difficult feelings. So that definitely, I feel, is one of the biggest obstacles. And if we can bring some self-compassion and curiosity to the process, you know, get a bit of distance from that kind of inner critic and approach it with, you know, a more compassionate and curious attitude, then we can, you know, at least give ourselves a little bit of relief from what we're experiencing in the moment in the name of putting into place and taking action, the kind of things that really produce those sustainable results long term.
And I think that leads us so nicely to talk about like binge eating, because you kind of said there that, you know, everybody wants that relief in the moment and bringing things in, like, you know, compassion and things like that can support that, but often don't feel quite as much as we need. Whereas, you know, the act of binge eating, that does provide that kind of, it's not long term in the slightest, it's very short term, but it provides that relief for people. So how do you work with your clients to kind of gain that sense of relief from something that isn't, you know, quite so negative on their life?
That's a really good question and a really good observation, because yeah, in some ways binge eating or leaning on food does feel like it serves us in the moment. So one of the fundamental things is to, on a very, it might sound boring, but like on a very practical level, before we dive into like mindset kind of work and any of that stuff, just making sure that on a very basic physiological level that we're getting enough food. I know that sounds boring and I'll get to some more interesting stuff in a second, but like there are techniques that can allow us to move through the discomfort that we might be using binge eating to escape from. However, if we're putting ourselves in a position where we're trying to implement great mindset kind of skill sets while at the same time being physiologically starved, there is no mindset work in the world that is going to be able to overcome a genuine need for a good variety and good quantity of nourishing and satisfying food. So before anything else, that's what I work with people on. We talk about, okay, what exactly is going on in terms of food? And that comes with its own challenges as well. Like if we've been dieting for a long time, getting comfortable with the fact that we might need to take a step back from dieting and just eat for optimal wellness without crossing the line into orthorexia. You know, that like that's a bit of a challenge. And then from there, really getting into how we're handling those moments of discomfort that we might be trying to escape from using food, leaning into some of that discomfort, putting some of our thoughts and feelings in perspective and developing a skill set, like a really strong skill set around managing discomfort, essentially understanding that these things do come in waves. These things are going to pass, and creating a way of dealing with those moments without feeling like we need to run from them or like we need to escape from them.
So I have a question, and I don't think it's just going to be a straightforward answer.
Sure.
But I think you hear a lot, you know, in eating disorder recovery in general, that kind of the first thing is that you need to be nourishing your body and eating enough. But if you have had an eating disorder, often you don't know like what is enough, and you're still not sort of recovered from that eating disorder. So there's a lot of thoughts around that's too much or that's too little or what have you. So how do you navigate ensuring that somebody's kind of eating adequately? Because I feel like that for me would be a complete minefield of like, well, I just don't know what's adequate.
Yeah, and that's a really, really good point. It's a difficult one, but it's a really good point. I'm glad you brought it up. It becomes a bit of a unique journey for everyone. Some people find a lot of benefit in me doing something like literally providing them with a visual representation of a, like, and this would be very triggering for some people, but not others. So we have to really have a few conversations and decide what is best. So just trigger warning for anyone who's very, very, who's fixating very much on calories and everything like that at the moment. There's no way to answer this question without talking about calories just a little bit. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So
maybe just not like specific numbers, but mentioning calories is fine.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I won't go into specific numbers at all. So for some people, it has helped them to, to give them like a visual representation of their daily calorie intake, setting the number aside completely and going, you know, when it comes to the foods that you enjoy and that are going to nourish you, well, like, this is literally the quantity of food that could be associated with a healthy daily intake for you, putting aside the dieting, putting aside the whatever, putting aside the numbers even, and just doing, I do my best to, in some cases, provide this visual representation. And for people who might be in a more difficult place, maybe a really difficult place, I'll always do my best to set aside what is ideal and what is perfect and to go, okay, where are you at right now? And what is a step that we might be able to take over the coming days or the coming weeks that you feel challenges you a little bit, but doesn't leave you feeling overwhelmed? Because we don't want to, like, we're talking about two different people here, essentially, and everyone in between on this kind of spectrum. We might have some people that have just been down a bit of a dieting rabbit hole and have really lost sight of how much food is the right amount for them. And then other people who are restricting quite heavily and have been through some trauma with that. And in that case, when someone is in a really difficult, painful place, then that becomes more of a thing of going, okay, let's put aside perfection and what might be, you know, the ideal right now. And let's just focus on taking a step in that direction without you feeling overwhelmed, because the moment someone feels overwhelmed in that situation, they're just going to go, I'm out.
Yep.
So, and also it's worth me mentioning here that, of course, I'm not a medical professional. I don't work in the capacity of like inpatient care. So I'm not working with people who have severe, like life-threatening issues with restriction.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working more in the disordered eating space than with people who might be experiencing very severe medical risks. So if we were to talk about what I do as a coach with people experiencing a lot of intrusive thoughts and obsessions surrounding food and of kind of getting in a bit of that loop, that is, again, that's a different conversation to like one of these amazing medical professionals who works in inpatient care with people who, you know, are in like life-threatening positions.
Yeah. I really like that. And I like the fact that you sort of, I mean, what is a perfect diet anyway, but that you step away from that with people and talk about sort of what's right in the moment for you right now. Because I think often when we think about recovery or eating disorder recovery, people tend to, it's very black and white, isn't it? And we'll think, you know, currently I'm eating this, and in order to be better, I need to eat this. And yeah. That is like so far apart that it feels completely impossible. But actually taking a step back and thinking, okay, what's something, you know, whether it's this week or today, that you can do that's manageable, but still challenges some part of that, so that we're keeping on board with, you know, moving towards that better life and that more healthier lifestyle, but not, you know, just like jumping in at the deep end. And I think there's a lot of like, you know, discussion around, should you just jump in at the deep end or should you take it slowly? And again, I think that completely depends on the person and their situation. You know, sometimes, like you said, if somebody's in a very severe state with their physical condition, it might be that they might just need to go in and at the deep end, and that might feel really uncomfortable. But I think, you know, if somebody's in a place where they, I would say that that's not actively engaging in recovery. I would say that that's like, you know, medical stabilization. When somebody's ready to actively engage in recovery and do that mindset work that you were talking about, taking things a bit slower and doing things, you know, at a pace that feels reasonable, I think that's going to make those long-term changes that we were talking about at the start. It's almost like, you know, you want to go on a diet, so you completely, you know, cut down your calories to nothing. That doesn't last. So if you do it the opposite way, that's also not going to last.
Yeah, absolutely. You're 100% right. And even in the situations when I do show people like a visual representation of like, you know, this could be, again, that visual representation of what a day's worth of food might look like for you. Even in that situation, I've never encountered a person who has not made the jump from where they are to that quote ideal day of food or that more ideal volume of food in one step. Even in those cases when I go, all right, here's the visual representation, it's still all in the name of helping people challenge their comfort zone a little bit and make those weekly or daily steps towards that, rather than feeling like everything should come all at once. I know introducing a lot of things all at once, I'm sure there's some people that works for like that in the deep end kind of way. But personally, that's not how I work. I work in steps with people a little bit more and try to help them to get a comfortable grasp of the big picture that we're working on, while also been focusing, okay, so that's the big picture, but here's the actionable thing that we're doing today.
Yeah. I think taking it one step at a time as well, like you said, really allows you to unpack things. And obviously a lot of the time with people that struggle with eating disorders, there's a massive element of food. Often food is almost the vehicle rather than the actual issue. And I think by taking it slower, it allows you to unpack maybe those kind of thoughts or unhelpful beliefs that you might have that then cause you to restrict or binge or whatever behavior you're engaging in. So how do you work with your clients to sort of work through to unpack those beliefs and then kind of support them to maybe change the beliefs that they've got about themselves or food or whatever?
I provide people with a lot of reflective questions. Something that I don't have to work really hard not to do this, because it's not really in my nature to do it anyway. But when people come and work with me, I do my best to make it really clear that they can share as much or as little of their personal life with me as they want to. If someone wants to share a lot, I'm here for that. If they want to say, this is what made me feel this way, and this is what made me feel that way, this is the experience that I feel led me to develop this belief, I 100% encourage that process of reflection. how much of that someone shares with me is completely up to them. So often I'll provide questions like, what could be your earliest memory of this particular feeling? Or when you think of, you know, the, when we establish what the voice of someone's personal critic or self-critic kind of sounds like, you know, who does that sound like? Does that remind you of anyone? You know, all these kind of questions to kind of establish a bit of a chain of events to understand a little bit more about, okay, why we might be feeling the way that we're feeling. Mm-hmm. And like I keep saying, in doing that, someone can share as much or as little of that with me as they like. And from there, with that understanding, it becomes a bit more about what I mentioned earlier in terms of creating the corrective experience, like being able to identify what circumstances led to the set of feelings that you currently have. So identifying what you were given as opposed to what you really needed. Mm-hmm. And then look at ways that we can get you what you need, get you the experience you need rather than the experience you had. Mm-hmm. And that often comes after a bit of a process of reflection. Again, how much of that process someone shares with me versus how much they do in their own journaling, in their own time. It's up to them, again, because I'm not a psychotherapist or psychologist or psychoanalyst, like I'm a coach. So yeah, how much someone shares is 100% their call.
Mm. I really like that. And I think it's so important. It's not something that I've really thought about before, but it's something that I'm working through in my own therapy, is really thinking about, you know, when did the eating disorder come along? And what was I missing in my life at that time, that then meant that I needed the eating disorder to sort of fill that gap. And I think often, because I've always thought, you know, oh, you had the perfect childhood and you've got no reason to have an eating disorder and all of this. And actually now we've been sort of reflecting on that. It's not like the classical things that you might think of in terms of, you know, neglect or things like that. And therefore you turn to the eating disorder, but more kind of not being able to have any autonomy or not being able to make my own decisions. And therefore the eating disorder comes in and is like, well, you don't need to make any decisions if I'm here because I make them all for you. I think it's really interesting to unpack that. And I'm sure there's so many different sort of reasons as to why somebody might feel sort of that they're lacking something and therefore kind of need the eating disorder to fill that hole. And then I think it's then becomes very scary when you think about letting go of the eating disorder, because for however long that's been your answer, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, what do I do now? Like, what do I replace it with?
Yeah, that's so true. I know that in my own journey with food, through my own like upbringing, food became very much the only, or one of the only methods, one of the only couple of methods I had for essentially self-soothing. Mm-hmm. And I know that I'm not unique in that experience, like not to diminish my experience, but I know there are so many of us out there who, you know, as a result of how we're raised and the environment that we're brought up in, again, like nobody's fault, like often in these situations, everyone's parents, everyone's family, everyone's like doing the best they can with the financial, physical, emotional resources that they had. But our developing minds draw conclusions about our experiences based on what limited experience we have. And that leads to certain beliefs, behaviors, whatever it might be. And sometimes we just need to untie a few of those knots like later down the track. But I know definitely that self-soothing was a role that food was playing in my life for a very, very long time before I developed a bit more awareness around that and started bringing a bit more self-compassion to the process. And that was really difficult because before I understood self-compassion, like properly, I always associated being kind to myself with letting go of any ambition, just essentially being lazy, letting myself go, not achieving anything, whatever. But it took me a long time to realize, like, that's not what self-compassion is. Mm. Self-compassion is doing the things that you feel, you know, that light you up, and even working really hard sometimes, but mm-hmm. acknowledging the fact that you're human throughout that process. And yeah, that's definitely been a journey.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's really interesting, this idea. I think we often, you know, if we think about self-care or self-compassion, it's often quite like airy-fairy and, you know, like doing yoga and stuff like that, and slowing down and doing face masks and lighting a candle. All things, can I add, that I absolutely despise. like, I'm also getting into the yoga now, actually. One of my friends is a yoga instructor and I am enjoying that, but they're not things that, you know, make me happy. Things that make me happy are like seeing my friends, or, yeah, you know, doing some art, or going to the gym if I've got the right intentions and things like that, getting outside and being active. And, you know, typically you might think, oh, but they're quite like intense things. But the compassion also for me comes in when I actually allow myself to be like, oh, I'm a little bit tired. You know, I'm a little bit socially exhausted, yeah, or I'm a little bit tired, so I'm not going to go for a hike today or whatever. It's that balance, I think, for me, that is when the self-compassion comes in. And then that's when, you know, when I really check in with myself, rather than like, no, that's the thing that you enjoy doing, so you've got to go and do it. Sometimes you do need to maybe chill on the sofa and watch your favorite movie. But it can be hard to find that balance, especially when, you know, you do have the mindset of, because it's that all or nothing again, isn't it? Of like, well, if you're not doing the things that you enjoy, then you're not looking after yourself.
Mm. Yeah, that's so true. The conclusions that we draw about what self-compassion or self-care is based on the well-publicized images that we see sometimes can confuse the process a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And I saw one of the emails that you sent out for your mailing list was about sort of like the reliability of food and the escape that the binge eating gave you. And I'm sure a lot of people could sort of resonate with that, so I wondered if you'd mind maybe sharing a bit of that, and then how you also stepped away from that, because I think that can feel quite overwhelming to think about not having those behaviors.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a really personal one for me, because I've got a few very vivid memories that are very much tied into that. Like, to share with you something really personal, I literally remember when my parents were getting divorced, the day that my dad actually packed the last of his stuff in his truck and drove away, the first thing that I was given was a Freddo frog, like a chocolate frog. Like, and then I have another, you know, there's all kinds of other memories that appear. But there's one in particular where I remember, like, as a teenager going to a party where someone I had this huge crush on at the time was there. And I was so socially awkward. Like, I was not the cool kid in school. And I was really socially awkward, partly because I was investing so much time and energy in an eating disorder and this obsession with how I looked, that I was behind in terms of how I was able to relate in social situations. Mm. So I always found parties and all these kind of things like really difficult. And I remember going to this particular party and, you know, this girl that I had this huge crush on at the time was there. I remember like her kind of like hooking up with someone else or whatever, and me going home and sitting at home by myself eating a box of like Cadbury's like favorites. Mm-hmm. And that experience of not really feeling like I was fitting in socially, not really feeling like I was able to relate, not really feeling like I understood what was going on, like when all my friends would go out clubbing and everything like that. Like I'd go out clubbing, and for me, I was there, like, it's noisy. At that stage, maybe this shows my age, people were still smoking in clubs. So I'm like, it's really noisy. It smells like shit. I can't have a conversation with a friend. Everyone's drinking like a lot. And I was too concerned about the calories to enjoy having drinks with friends. So there was like nothing for me in that environment. So I would always bail early and stop at the 7-Eleven on the way home and grab a block of chocolate and a bag of crisps or, you know, whatever it was, and then go home and spend the rest of the evening watching a movie by myself with food, because that was the most reliable experience that I had at the time. It was always there. And personally, the process of, or a big part of the process of breaking away from that, was feeling more secure in my own individuality. Stepping away from being hyper-focused on weight and shape to the point where it was stunting me socially. Like that was obviously a big part of it, like stressing about that stuff less, or going through what I needed to go through to stress about that stuff less in the name of being more available emotionally and mentally to participate socially in things, which left me feeling less alone. And then as well, really becoming more secure in the fact that I didn't like stuff like clubbing. I didn't like the things that so many of my peers were doing, and being okay with going, you know what, I don't like this scene. So regardless of what it means about me being cool or not, or whatever the fuck, I'm going to go and find people who I feel in alignment with. And that process then meant that, you know, I didn't really have to rely on food for that role in my life anymore. It still required a bit of time to untie some of the knots with food, because I would still then habitually lean on food. So then that became about making some more mindful decisions after that, and challenging the well-ingrained habit. But making those changes in my life and fulfilling the needs that I had without food was really important.
Yeah. Well, I'm really appreciative of you sharing that. I think a lot of people will be able to resonate with what you've gone through. And I definitely think, you know, those experiences of when a tough thing happens as a child to be given food. I completely, you know, can relate to that. And it was always, food was a treat, or food was something that you got when either you were good or when you were sad, or things like that. But I really liked what you were saying about, you know, I think often as well, we will be in a situation where we don't feel like we fit in, and food does allow you. It's something that you kind of, you know, you have a relationship with food that is yours and that is your own. And you can feel so lonely in the world if you've not quite found your people, but food provides you an escape from that loneliness, whether it's, you know, it numbs your emotions, or it distracts you, or just takes you away for a bit. It gives you something that maybe you're missing from socializing with people or whatever, because you haven't quite found your thing. And I think that is something that's so important, is, you know, through recovery, or, you know, if you're exploring your relationship with food, kind of understanding who you are really and what your values are and what's important to you. And then that allows you to find other people that have similar things, but also it allows you to be honest with yourself, rather than, I think a lot of the time the uncomfortableness can come because we aren't being honest with ourselves about who we are. And so that feels uncomfortable and you feel like a bit of a fraud. So you lean into food. But actually being able to, you know who you are deep down, you don't then need the eating disorder to sort of fill those gaps.
I agree so much. So much.
And then the final thing that I wanted to ask you, because I saw that you had a post post about it was just thinking about some stress management techniques that you might use for your with your clients, just if someone's listened and thought, oh my god, I resonate with this so much, just some handy tips that they could take away.
Sure. So prevention is always best.
Mm-hmm.
First, so my first port of call when I'm working with someone is to look at things like work-life balance, sleep, all those kinds of things. And in no way is my own process of like sleep and work-life balance and everything like that always perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't want anyone to ever think that they need to get their perfect 8 hours every single night with this perfect bedtime routine and the perfect work-life balance. Like, those things don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Though it helps to be able to recognize when we're doing something that might be, you know, difficult but sustainable, or, you know, slightly less than ideal but still sustainable, and we can still find a way to be healthy during this situation, or if we're doing something that's just like, this is not doing you any favors whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, having some semblance of, you know, a regular sleep routine and looking at work-life balance. And work-life balance can be a really difficult one because, you know, this, not everyone works for themselves. And whether you work for yourself or whether you're employed, you've got certain responsibilities and things to do and family commitments and everything like that. So I would say, try not to look at your life situation and think, oh god damn it, this is so up the creek that there's no wiggle room anywhere. Like, this is so up the creek that I may as well just not make any changes anywhere. Like, really allow yourself to go, okay, if I make like a few 1% changes wherever I can, you know, even if it's something around bedtime or hydration or something, a series of 1% changes in terms of preventing burnout and preventing exhaustion are going to be really important. Secondly, the company that we keep, to be honest, like, who are you hanging out with? Who are you spending the most time with? It's a difficult one, I know, but are those relationships really doing you any favors? Mm-hmm. Like, I had a client literally yesterday tell me about his parents visiting for Easter and, you know, sitting at the table for dinner, and his mum just not being able to talk about anything other than food and dieting and all this kind of stuff. And obviously this guy, he's not going to cut his mum out of his life, right? Like, there are some people that we can't cut certain people out of our lives, but we can go into interactions with those people with a little bit more mindfulness, a little bit more perspective, and maybe not spend all of our time with them. Maybe draw a few healthy boundaries in terms of how much time we spend with people who might be a little bit draining on all fronts. So again, it's not going to be perfect. Don't expect perfection. Just if we can move the needle a little bit in a number of different areas, we're going to experience like a measurable difference. So our basic habits, preventing burnout, the company we keep, when we actually experience maybe being triggered or moments of stress that have crept up on us. So there's that difference between preemptive action and then response focused action. We need different actions and skill sets for both. In more kind of response focused action, I've got a number of different clients that approach this from different angles. My personal approach is to get very physiology focused. So I might be in a situation where I might be experiencing a confrontation, or like something might not be going right. I might be feeling triggered, and I really get mindful about the physical experience of the emotion that I'm going through at that period of time. So rather than let my thoughts and my head kind of like run away with me in dealing with stress, I'll do my best to bring my attention out of my head and into my present moment, like physical experience. I'll do things like, okay, what can I manage in this moment? I can adjust my breathing. I can adjust my posture. I can take a moment. I can focus on the single task that I have in front of me rather than getting overwhelmed trying to think of the backlog of things or big to-do lists that might be in the back of my mind. So trying to bring ourselves into the present moment and manage the physical symptoms of stress as a response if you just find yourself dumped into that moment despite your best efforts to offset it. That combination of things is usually the first port of call to kind of get a foothold in stress management.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. I think you gave such an incredibly thorough sort of overview there. So thank you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, no, that's going to be so helpful for people. I am so sure that people will want to hear more from you. You've given so many great tips and insights throughout the podcast. So where can they go to find out more about you?
Thank you so much, Hannah. My Instagram is a reliable place to find me, M Cain Coaching. That's MKAIN Coaching. And my podcast, Strong Not Starving, is another reliable place to get hold of me. So those are probably the two most reliable ports of call.
Amazing. And the podcast, what sort of content, what sort of things do you chat about on your podcast?
Very much breaking away from disordered eating patterns and stress and anxiety surrounding food and body image and creating more rewarding relationship with nutrition and food and exercise. So that's definitely what I focus on in that podcast, with a bit of an emphasis on breaking cycles of binge eating, because obviously binge eating was such a big hurdle for me for so many years that I've put extra effort into making sure that I'm really upskilled and know what's going on in that particular area of things. So binge eating and our pathway out of binge eating is always a cornerstone of what I'm presenting. And then beyond that, we look at, creating that more rewarding relationship with food and exercise.
Yeah, that sounds brilliant. Sounds definitely like it aligns with this podcast very well.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. And thank you so much for the invitation. Your questions have been really amazing. I've really enjoyed chatting with you.
Yeah, no, it's been lovely. It's been so nice to explore it with you and get all your insight and everything. So I'm glad that you enjoyed the conversation.
You'll definitely have to come and visit us on Strong Not Starving.
Oh, please. I'd absolutely love it. If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.